first. 12 years ago, there was a terrible traffic accident outside Jerusalem. 6 children were killed in that, and 1 teacher, and many other people were also badly hurt and scarred. Now, just one of those things you could say, the sort of thing that could happen anywhere in the world. And of course, there's been no shortage of tragedy in that part of the world down the years, and of course right now, as we've been hearing in the news today. But an entire book about exactly how one single crash happened 12 years ago, you think might have been a bit of a tough one to pitch to a publisher. But the US-born writer Nathan Thrall, who's based in Jerusalem, has pulled it off to huge acclaim in A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, A Palestine Story. Now, Abed is the father of a 5-year-old boy called Malad, who died in that crash. But the book isn't really about either of them. It's all about the tangle of enmities and politics and history and geography that all formed the backdrop to that terrible accident that happened back in 2012.
You know, I live in the city of Jerusalem, which is where most of the people who populate this book live as well. And just to give you a bit of a sense of the place, you know, I live very close to the walls of the old city of Jerusalem, and I'm about 2 miles away from a different kind of wall, which is a 26-foot tall gray separation barrier, sometimes known as the apartheid wall, which puts a large number of Palestinian residents of the city outside of the center of the city, and they have to cross through a checkpoint to come into the center of the city to their jobs and schools. And the people who live in this part of the city, a small town called Anata, which is partially annexed by Israel, partially unannexed, they live a radically different existence than mine, and they're just 2 miles away from me. And when this tragedy occurred, and I'll tell you in a moment what the book is about, you know, I was deeply moved by the story. It haunted me, and I thought a lot about these people who live just on the other side of the wall, share the same city as me, but really have a totally different existence than mine. And it was very easy for me to live here for years without thinking about how these other people lived in the city. The book tells the story of a tragic bus accident involving a group of kindergartners who came from this area, from a school in the town of Anata in the greater Jerusalem area. And the kids on this school bus were on their way to a play area on the outskirts of Ramallah. And they were struck by a giant semi-trailer that was on its way to a settlement quarry, picking up stones from the West Bank and bringing them to a factory in a settlement industrial zone in East Jerusalem. The school bus flipped over, caught fire, and 6 children and 1 teacher died. And the emergency services were very late to come because the people who live on the other side of the wall live in a state of utter neglect. The Palestinian Authority, the self-governing body for the Palestinians, which is allowed to operate in certain limited areas within the West Bank, is not allowed in the area where the accident occurred. And the Israeli emergency services largely neglect these areas, which roads that are used primarily by Palestinians. And so who was left to deal with this tragedy of this burning bus were just ordinary people who were on their way to work in the morning. And they pulled over to the side of the road and started to help rescue these soot-covered 5-year-old children from the bus and carry them off to different hospitals. And because of the complexity of their lives and of the permit system, some of them had green-colored IDs, which do not allow them to enter Jerusalem. Some of them had blue-colored IDs that do allow them to enter Jerusalem, where there are superior hospitals. And so the kids were taken off in different directions, depending on the color of the ID of the Palestinian driver who was putting them in the back of his or her car. And so I tell the story of this crash and of a number of different Jewish and Palestinian characters whose lives intersect on this day. And in particular, I tell the story of one father, Abed Salama, whose son Milad was on the bus. And Abed, raced to the site of the accident. And by when at the time that he got there, he was shocked to discover all the kids were already gone. And he asked where they were. And people in the crowd told him that they were at a hospital in Jerusalem that he couldn't access, another hospital in Jerusalem that he couldn't access with his green ID, that they were at a military base a minute up the road, that they were at a Ramallah hospital. And so he went to the place that he could access, the Ramallah hospital. And we follow his journey over the next more than a day to try and locate his son, to call on relatives who have blue colored ID that could go and check for him at Jerusalem hospitals. And through his journey to try and find his son, we meet many other people who were involved in one way or another in the accident, including the founder of the settlement. Right next to where the accident took place. And really the aim of the book is through these people's lives is to give the entire story of Israel-Palestine in within just a few days surrounding this tragic event.
Yes, Nathan, I looked up some of the news reports from the time just to see how was this incident reported, because it's so bad, just as a road traffic accident. And yeah, sure enough, there are reports there of parents, 5-year-olds who were thought dead suddenly being found in a hospital, a couple of days later that people weren't aware, and that's why. It says there are still no official figures on the number of dead or wounded, says one news story, since the victims are spread out at hospitals in both the Palestinian territories and Israel. And those parents had to spend days, didn't they, leveraging connections with people who had those blue IDs.
Yes. That one of the aims of the book was not just to tell the story of Israel-Palestine, but to explain the permit system, to explain this very, very complex, multi-layered system of control that exists for the Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza as well. It's and the way that I felt that one could really understand that system best was to put yourself in the shoes of a parent who's having to navigate it just to try and find their own child on the worst day of their life.
Yeah, one reviewer, Nathan, said, the depth of Mr. Thrall's knowledge adds weight to his judgments, though there are parts that read a bit too much like a think tank report, which I think is pretty harsh, because you do detail all this forensically, very matter-of-factly, but this is a human story, isn't it? Because the point is here, you've got the backstories of all these people involved. And when you look at those, and sometimes that's your starting point before you even learn of their connection to the accident, you realize what their experience has been. And that's Palestinians and also Jewish Israelis that are part of the story or connected to it.
That's right. It's interesting that you say that. I actually am curious to hear where you saw that review because I hadn't seen that line. A lot of the reviews have referred to it as a nonfiction novel. Although I did have this goal of explaining the system in which these people live, my aim was to show everything purely through the eyes of the characters. And so every bit of history that comes into it is really it's a piece of family history. It's something that comes about naturally in the course of the telling of the story. Because I really wanted it to be as immersive as possible, which really put handcuffs on me in terms of how I could structure the book and what I could get into and what I couldn't. But the real aim was to give a person a visceral sense of what it's like to live in this place as both a Palestinian and a Jew.
The interesting thing is, I guess you were also an analyst for a think tank, the International Crisis Group, in your years in Jerusalem. In that role, I think you had to brief diplomats and visitors on the situation. Maybe this was an opportunity to write, you know, not as an analyst, to actually do a human story, albeit that you had to get all the facts right and absolutely do it as an in-depth work of nonfiction.
Absolutely. I mean, that was a new form of writing that I very much enjoyed doing, but very much with the aim of reaching a broader audience than I could reach with the kinds of writings that I had previously been doing, either for the International Crisis Group or just more analytical historical articles that I'd written in publications like the London Review of Books and the New York Review of Books. So, I had the explicit goal here of reaching people who didn't necessarily care about Israel-Palestine. Obviously, I was writing it before it was on the front page of all the newspapers before October 7th. But the aim was to reach people who might be past the book just because it's a moving story about a parent, a group of parents trying to find their children. And through the course of reading that story, one would learn about the situation of in Israel-Palestine and come away with a gut understanding of what it really is to live here.
Mm. And key to that really is this restriction of movement, isn't it? You talked about the wall or walls and the ID system. And I guess, is that the stuff when we hear about the conflict, that's something we can't bear in mind, the fact that it starts to make sense when you look at a story like this, where someone has to respond in a disaster and suddenly things can't play out as they normally would because simply people can't move in ways that makes sense when they need to. That's why there were no rescue services or police or military on the scene, you know, of what was clearly a terrible accident, which should have been priority number one in that time.
Yeah. You know, the first fire trucks didn't arrive at the accident site until more than a half hour after the crash had taken place. It's really hard to overstate the degree of neglect of deliberate neglect, a policy of neglect toward these hundreds of thousands of people who live on the other side of this wall. And many of these are people who are Jerusalem residents paying municipal taxes to the city, receiving virtually no services, and even emergency services refusing to enter these areas without police or army escort. And so, you know, in many ways, this is the story of an accident that played out in a very unaccidental way. It played out in a very predictable way because of these policies that are designed to push as many Palestinians out of the heart of Jerusalem as possible.
And that was actually the reason that an aging busload of kindergarten age kids was off to a fun park, you know, some distance from where they live on a bad road on a strange and potentially dangerous route anyway, right?
That's exactly right. So the community that they live in, you know, this walled enclave, it's surrounded by this 26-foot tall gray concrete wall on three sides, and it has a different kind of wall on a fourth side running through a segregated road, Route 4370, sometimes called the Apartheid Road. This is about 130,000 people living in this walled ghetto, all of them Palestinian, and they do not have a single playground. They do not have ATMs. They do not have sidewalks. The main thoroughfare for all of these people is a road that, you know, two cars can barely pass each other on. So you have enormous traffic piled up, and you have a checkpoint at the top of it that all of these people have to wait to go through in order to enter Jerusalem, those who do have the right color ID. And within the school itself, you had students who had blue Jerusalem IDs, who came from families with blue Jerusalem IDs, and you had students with green West Bank IDs. And so as a result of that, the bus couldn't just go through the checkpoint and go to very nearby play areas in Jerusalem, just on the other side of the wall. They had to follow the winding path of the wall through a checkpoint and go to a very distant play area on the outskirts of Ramallah, because some of these students were simply unable to enter the play areas just on the other side of the wall. And at a, even, you know, at another layer, the very fact that all of these parents with Blue Jerusalem IDs who are paying municipal taxes and are entitled to send their kids to schools in Jerusalem, the schools within the enclave, there were very few options. You know, there was one, basically one public school that was in a former goat shed. And so the parents were looking at the choice of either sending their kids through a checkpoint every day and confronting soldiers on their way to and from school each day, which made these parents very nervous, or to send them to a private school in Annata for those who could afford it. And that's what the parents with blue IDs at this school did.
Although there were people at the scene who had to improvise the rescue of the children that could be saved and so on, and there were officials there who did arrive, both Palestinian and Israelis, who kind of put aside the usual rules, didn't they, just in order to get things done, surveyed the situation, said, right, we need to do these things. And so that did happen, didn't it?
It did. You know, the scale of the tragedy was so great. Members of the Palestinian Authority, Interior Ministry, and security forces came to the scene of the accident, even though they are forbidden from going there. And they had a dialogue with the Israeli army commander in charge of that area. And they asked for something unprecedented, which was to be given a kind of temporary control of the accident site, because it's all Palestinians there, and they felt that everything would go much more smoothly if people weren't dealing with this tragedy at the same time as they're dealing with Israeli soldiers shoving them around. And so the soldiers did agree to give them some operational control at the site of the accident.
And Nathan, you used the word you called it apartheid roads, and you even referred earlier to the apartheid wall. And in the, I mean, that is a term that will get people's backs up. Some people don't like that comparison at all with the South African experience. But as you say in the book, these are terms that are used privately by Israeli officials when describing either the plan to wall off and separate communities for security purposes, and specifically about that road. I mean, that was exactly the way that some officials had described those roads, isn't it? That's the terminology they themselves used.
Yes, that's right. The at the most senior levels of the Israeli government, you know, a very, very senior official in the Israeli Defense Ministry was referring to them as apartheid roads. And the reason we know about this are the WikiLeaks cables that the Americans were sending to one another. And they were recording their conversations with the Israeli officials, and the Israeli officials were themselves referring to them as apartheid roads. And of course, you know, aside from these cables, there are very senior Israelis, former ministers, the former Attorney General of Israel, the you know highest legal authority, who has said Israel is practicing apartheid.
Well, I'm talking to Nathan Thrall. He's the US-born, Jerusalem-based analyst and journalist who's the author of A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, A Palestine Story. Well, Nathan, the timing of the publication of your book, October the 3rd last year, it first came out, and just 4 days later, you know, the Hamas attacks over the border, and, you know, the whole situation that we have now has begun to unfold straight after that. How did you feel when you heard that? Because you had, I think, publicity tours with Abed himself taking part, all organized.
That's right. You know, he and I, Abed and I, were planning to be in the US and the UK for 5 to 6 weeks to talk about the book and to talk about Abed's story. And we had just begun the first several days of that when October 7th happened. And, you know, everyone's world was turned upside down. Abed himself had to cut the tour short and come back to be with his family. As I mentioned a little while ago, the community of Ennahta, it's encircled by the wall, which means, and there's a checkpoint at one end of it and just a small gate that can be closed at the other end, which means that it's very, very easy for Israeli soldiers to lock in these 130,000 people. It takes, three soldiers to close a checkpoint and close a gate at the other end. And that's what happened to Abed's family in the immediate aftermath of October 7th. And that w was a story that played out across the West Bank. To this day, we have the greatest restrictions on movement that there have ever been in the West Bank. It's taking people, three, four times as long as it used to get from one place to another. And there's been a big spike in settler violence. Abed's son was told he should not go to work anymore in Ramallah because the roads were unsafe due to settler violence. And the entire economy is constricted because so much of the economy in the West Bank depends on higher paying jobs in Israel and in the settlements. And almost all of those have disappeared since October 7th, all but a very small number. And so people are choked. They're choked financially. They're being driven off their land by settlers. There have been over 1,000 Palestinians forcibly displaced since in just the month after October 7th in the West Bank. And so it's a very, very grim situation right now, and one that we couldn't have foreseen when we started on this tour.
So when that happened in October, I mean, there's a photograph on your Twitter account of Abed himself in, I think, a Barnes and Noble bookstore in, I think, New York, posing beside piles of books of your book that bear his name, about the death of his son and his friends in that bus crash, and nothing to do with the conflict in that sense directly, and yet he was so the some of the appearances for the pair of you were actually cancelled or postponed because of the October 7th attacks and the atrocities, and people thinking, what, just too soon to discuss your book? Was that the response?
I mean, in the immediate aftermath of October 7th, and some of this persists to this day, there was an absolute intolerance for any kind of discussion of the reality of Palestinian life under occupation. Now, much of this was pushed by groups who would have liked to have shut down our events prior to October 7th. And they merely had the opportunity now to advance that argument successfully. But yeah, there was a real atmosphere of hostility. In our biggest event of the entire tour was at a 400-seat, venue in London at Conway Hall, and the UK police shut that one down. They that same week, the UK police shut down other events that had Palestine in the title. One was just a traditional music concert at a church in London. There was just a very, very strong backlash, and anything that was perceived as sympathetic to Palestinians living under occupation or just descriptive of the history of Israel-Palestine couldn't be heard on the grounds that, oh, that is a justification. If you provide context, that's a justification. You're justifying the attack, which is nonsense, but it worked.
Well, so for one, for example, was a New York synagogue, which was going to host a discussion with you. And their response, I would say, as has been reported, wasn't necessarily hostile or anything like that, but basically saying, ah, in light of these events, let's do this later. I think when calm is restored is the phrase. Well, yeah, all these months later, it's far from calm. But did you fear that? And not just for yourself, for Abed and all the other people that opened up and told their stories, that maybe, you know, what happened on October the 7th and since has made your book a bit irrelevant for some people, that, you know, this vignette more than 10 years in the past is now, you know, just historic?
So both of those things. I mean, I think that there are people that I really hoped to reach with this book that I think probably their ears are still closed to any kind of description of how Palestinians live under occupation. That for sure existed, and that was the case with this synagogue that canceled my event with Abed. But at the same time, I have had many people who have read the book and felt deeply grateful for it because, unfortunately, it is describing a system that still exists today, and it exists during this war, and it will exist after this war. And you know, the basic logic of this system is one that's also applied to Gaza. You know, Abed's community of Anata is a densely populated area that Israel had no hope of actually settling because there are just too many Palestinians living in it. So the approach was to wall it off. And that was exactly the same thing that was done with Gaza.
Are you, Nathan, are you yourself unpopular within Israel? I mean, you live there, you have a family. You know, you're described often as a critic of Israel. You contradict that line of that people often say, describe Israel as the only democracy in the Middle East. You're pointing out there are, you know, millions of people in the territory that don't have full voting rights, let alone full movement of freedom, which is so much the focus of your book. Is it uncomfortable for you to live there and the way people react to you?
It only in the sense of feeling, you know, alienated from the mainstream of this society, which is now justifying a policy of mass starvation in Gaza and thinks that the right amount of force has been applied in Gaza. In an internal way, I feel alienated from that mainstream discourse, but so far it hasn't reached the level of you know, the government pushing me out, though it has done that to friends of mine. You know, a friend of mine was the head of the Israel-Palestine program for Human Rights Watch, and he was told to leave, and that his visa would not be renewed, and that he could never come back to Israel-Palestine because they didn't like the reporting that he was doing. You know, that kind of thing absolutely does happen, and I think will continue to happen. And at the same time, you know, I have very good friends who are Jews and Palestinians who see eye to eye with me, and who are my, you know, years long close friends and colleagues who are working every day to try and you know, chip away at this system that seems so robust and so difficult to change.
But for example, though, Nathan, you've described Anata as a ghetto of neglect and used that word a few times. I mean, that's quite an inflammatory word, isn't it? Because, you know, the parts of Jewish history in 20th century Europe where, you know, they were quite literally ghettoized, that is a provocative word to use in Israel?
Absolutely. It's one that that people bristle at, but it is a walled ghetto. There is no other way to describe it. You stand on the grounds of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem at Mount Scopus, the most prestigious university in Israel, and you literally can look down on this walled ghetto, this densely populated area with 130,000 people without sidewalks, without playgrounds, who are receiving virtually no services from the city to which they are paying taxes. And they can be locked within it, as they were after October 7th. The walls of the ghetto, you know, the gates of the ghetto can be closed. And there's just, there's no way around seeing this enclave as anything other than a ghetto.
Well, it's subtitled A Palestine Story, but Nathan, you've also included the backstories of Israelis who are connected to this awful road accident in 2012. For example, one who appears is Dubi Weisenstern, a member of a volunteer organization that collects and prepares bodies of people that have been killed in attacks mostly. He tells a horrible story about collecting victims of a suicide bombing and being told later that they've returned parts of 15 bodies, but they have 16 hearts, and things having to deal with things like that. And also, Danny Tirza, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, the so-called
That's right.
architect of the wall that you mentioned. He plotted the route of the wall that you've referred to, that goes through
That's right.
Jerusalem, much of the West Bank. But as you claim, when you go into his backstory, how he ended up, his family ended up in Israel, and he doesn't have a direct connection to events of the day, but you've been certain to include him in the story because the wall itself is part of it. And as we learn from you talking to him, part of what he was doing initially was hoping to implement the Oslo Accords back in the early 90s. He thought this might be a part of a peace strategy, albeit that he was also a member of the Israeli Defense Force as well, right?
And himself a settler who lives in a settlement that's on the land of Abed's town of Annetta. I mean, this town is this tiny rump of what it used to be because it's been appropriated for settlements, including the one that Danny lives on, and a giant military base and a natural reserve, a park that's part of Israel's National Park Service, and a number of settler outposts, and they have plans for much more.
But when you interview him, he's clearly telling you that when they're designing the wall where it would go, there are times when they have to push back against settlers that wanted to expand further. And, so the forces pushing on Israelis as part of this process, that's part of the story too, isn't it?
Absolutely. It was very important for me to show the perspective of people like Danny, who sincerely conceives of himself as a peacemaker despite living on in a settlement in the West Bank. In my view, he's a supporter of the Trump plan that was released in January 2020, which I think almost any observer of Israel-Palestine, any longtime observer of Israel-Palestine will tell you has zero chance of ever being accepted by Palestinians. So he conceives of himself as a peacemaker, and he just has a very unrealistic, in my view, picture of what that peace ought to look like.
And the epilogue for the book, Nathan, has the Israeli television reporter Arik Weiss in it, and how he, for an Israeli TV show, tracked down a bunch of people who'd made awful social media posts in response to that accident, and discovered that some of them turned out to be teenagers celebrating the death of young Palestinians, and confronting some of them who were quite unapologetic, which is, quite chastening to read about. But also, Eric spoke to, for example, a settler that collected money. You've documented this in the book, collected money for the families. They made signs of condolence and so on. So the fact that the hostility isn't universal, that's something you wanted to get across in the book as well.
Yeah, it was important for me, to show all of the conflicts that exist within these societies. I mean, for the most part, this place is so segregated that, I'm trying to put you in the shoes of these characters
Yeah,
and
the guy who
who.
actually collected the money also felt he couldn't go in person into Annetta and actually hand it over, that he wouldn't be
Yes,
safe.
yes, yes. He was afraid to go. And so because of that extreme segregation, who it is that you think about in your daily life are If you're Palestinian or fellow Palestinians and you're thinking about the rifts and conflicts within your society, and similarly with Jews. So it was very important for me to faithfully reflect the diversity of views. Abed is against the Palestinian Authority, but he has a cousin who's a senior official in the Palestinian Authority, in the Interior Ministry, who works hand in glove with Israeli generals and is proud of it, and calls those Israeli generals his friends. And he was at the scene of the accident, and he talks about how those friendships have resulted in small changes that have helped Palestinians. And similarly, among Jews, I show not just the perspective of a settler like Danny, but also a very different kind of story of a settler like Bever Vanunu, who founded the settlement Adam right next to where the accident took place, who is a Moroccan-born Jew who, in many ways, embodies the story of the discrimination against Jews from the Middle East and North Africa
Are these the
by the.
Mizrahim? Is that what they're called?
That's right. They're called Mizrahi Jews, Eastern Jews, who are not, for the most part, the founders of the state. Almost all. 11 out of 12 of the first of the ministers of the first government of Israel were from the former Russian Empire, and the state was very much founded by Ashkenazi Jews, Jews from Europe, Jews from the former Russian Empire largely, and from other parts of Europe. And the Mizrahi Jews, the Eastern Jews, face severe discrimination. Bever, the founder of this settlement of Adam, deeply resents that discrimination to this day. And he had a unique motivation in creating this settlement to help his own people and to give them, to move them out of the slums in Jerusalem, in which they lived, and to give them single family homes in the Jerusalem area, on cheaper land because the government subsidizes settlements and tries to encourage people to move to them. And you mentioned, another Jewish character whose view I felt was important to show, a couple of them who work for Zaka, the emergency service organization that comes and cleans up largely, bodies and body parts at the site of attacks or accidents. And they are ultra-Orthodox Jews. One of them who considers himself, staunchly anti-Zionist and who doesn't believe that Israel should exist as a Jewish state, and thinks it's actually a sacrilege that that it's religiously prohibited for Jews to have created a Jewish state in Palestine prior to the coming of the Messiah. So all of these rifts are very real, and play an important part in the politics here. And I thought it would be really doing a disservice to the reader not to show that diversity of views.
Well, Abed's oldest son, Adam, I think spoke about the accident for the first time during sessions where you sat with the family to talk about what happened and to learn about all the backstory that informs the book. The older brother of Milad who died age 5 in that horrible accident. So clearly participating in the book and talking to you has changed things for them. And Abed himself going on tour with you in the United States with the backdrop of the October 7th attacks and everything that came after going on, that must have been a bit surreal. But how is Abed and the rest of the family doing now?
Like many people in the West Bank right now, they are suffering financially. They're feeling great despair. They're members of the family that are in Gaza, who have died in Gaza. That this is it's Ramadan now, and there is a state of mourning, and it's one of the most quiet Ramadans, the most subdued that I can remember. And I think everybody is feeling real despair over the future of this place, and it doesn't feel like things are going to get better anytime soon. It really feels, I think, to many people like this is the beginning of a darker period, even if this war ends, that we have entered a new and much darker phase of this conflict.
And possibly a bit of a sliding doors moment for you yourself before you moved to Jerusalem. According to one of the profiles of you here, you had ambitions to get into the film business. I think you even worked on the Russell Crowe movie Master and Commander. Could things have
I
worked out
did.
very differently if you'd decided not to go deep into journalism and an analyst based in Jerusalem?
Yes, yeah. It was my great good fortune to work on a film with a crew of Australians. I was working in film editing. They were the loveliest people and very different from the kind of typical folks working in Hollywood.
Oh, it was a Peter Weir
And
movie, wasn't it? Master and Commander.
yes,
Yeah.
exactly. It was a Peter Weir movie, and I was a had just graduated from college and got to drive Peter Weir around from one place to another and had some conversations with him, greatly admire him. But yes, my grandparents actually, it's funnily enough, I don't think this is what brought me to this particular story, but they passed away in a car accident. My grandmother passed away in a car accident. My grandfather died a number of years later. That really changed my whole life because my grandparents raised me as much as my own parents, and I quit my job in film editing. I had finished the Peter Weir film and was working on a different one, and I moved back to be with my parents. And it was really at that moment that my mom suggested to me that I take a trip to Israel, to which I'd never been, and I came and took a trip. Here, I was told my grandmother always wanted to come to Jerusalem and be here with me. And it was very kind of, I was mourning her. So I was see looking at this place through that grief. And then I became very, hooked on Israel-Palestine and understanding it and writing about it. And I just changed my whole life and became a journalist and then an analyst and started to devote myself to trying to change things here.
I've looked up the quote, by the way. I think it was in The Guardian. They said parts of it maybe read like a bit of a think tank report. But I think they're just saying that because you'd written an article for the New York Review of Books, a shorter one, that was expanded into the story with all the backstory, the context that makes the story so rich. So in the end, I don't think it's necessarily a criticism.
Yeah, you know what? I actually Googled it also, and I see that it was The Economist, I think.
Oh, the Econo- Oh, you're right. Yes, here it is. You're absolutely right. So
And
that would be unauthored because The Economist doesn't publish the bylines of their
but
authors.
it's okay. They named it a best book of 2023, so I'm willing to overlook that slight.
Indeed, indeed. I don't necessarily think it is a slide. I think it's just pointing to the let's say the depth, the thoroughness of it. It's funny, like when I went online to look for Eric Weiss's television report that we mentioned earlier, it brings up a couple of questions. I said on Google, people also search for, is this a true story? Which I think would frustrate you, but you did put a note at the end before all the references and so on, which make it clear how well researched it is. There's a note to say this is absolutely a true story and only four names have been changed. And I mean, clearly it's a true story. Anyone who's read it would realize. And then the second thing that people were asking is, what religion is Nathan Thrall? So I guess that probably is in the back of people's minds.
Well, as for the first part, no, I actually don't, that doesn't bother me at all. I'm very glad to hear that people who read it feel that it reads like a novel, because that was really the aim. It was to make it digestible for a broad audience and to make them feel that it was, at its core was telling a story, and through that story to get them to feel what it's like to live here. I know I take that as the highest form of praise, actually.
And will you stay in touch with Abed and the family?
Oh, I'm in constant touch with Abed. My family's going to go and have iftar with him, break the fast with him next week. Yeah, we talk all the time. He just bought some gifts for my daughters who are looking forward to seeing his daughter. And yeah, no, that's a lifelong friendship.
And volume two, somewhere down the track, maybe?
Well, I definitely hope to write another work of narrative nonfiction set in Israel-Palestine, but I don't know what that story is going to be yet.
That's Nathan Thrall, whose book is A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, a Palestine Story. That's published here by Penguin Random House NZ. And yeah, all about a bus tragedy that happened 12 years ago in the West Bank. Interesting, he's got a quote from the philosopher Stanley Cavell right at the front of the book. We don't see our hand in what happens, as we call certain events melancholy accidents when they are the inevitabilities of our projects, and we call other events necessities merely because we will not change our minds.